Hello, this is Magnus Carter with the Southwest Business Report. The CBI and the Institute of Directors have both expressed doubts about HS2, though the British Chambers of Commerce are in favour. Political opinion on both sides of the House of Commons is also divided, many now fearing, like former Chancellor Alistair Darling, that costs, currently put at a touch over £46 billion, will continue to escalate. And if they do, even the Paddington to Bristol mainline electrification may be put at risk, according to Mr. Darling. So how do the train operators for our region see it? Mark Hopwood is Managing Director of First Great Western. He says HS2, far from diverting resources from the rest of the country, will directly benefit First Great Western passengers.
I don't see that project being driven forward presents any problems for us driving forward our investment agenda for the services out of Paddington. The electrification of the main line out of London to Bristol and to Cardiff is authorised, the work has started, and that's a committed scheme. Our new Hitachi high-speed trains are ordered, that's a committed contract. Those trains have already started being designed and built in Japan. I see opportunities for us to actually ride on the back of the success of High Speed 2. You know, High Speed 2 will have a new station at Old Oak Common in West London, which will link High Speed 2 with the Great Western Main Line and with Heathrow Express, and potentially in the future with Eurostar. So that means people travelling from Bristol, Bath, other places in the West Country will be able to get to Old Oak Common and interchange there with a wider choice of trains than pretty much anywhere else in the whole of the UK.
So that electrification project for the main line through to Cardiff, that is definitely going ahead in your view. There's nothing that you've heard about HS2 or indeed about the row over franchising that will hold that back.
Absolutely. The electrification of the main line out of Paddington's a committed scheme. Work has already started. If you travel through Reading and look out of the window, you'll see the electrification masts are already going up. There are some people who want to create some scare stories about investment in other parts of the railway being affected by HS2, but there's no evidence that that's the case at all. And the investment on routes out of Paddington to the West Country will continue. The industry's committed to that. It's needed, and I'm sure that that will deliver benefits in due course. It's a shame at a time that we're bringing unprecedented levels of investment into the rail industry that people are so desperate to go looking for negative news stories. This is a positive story. This is the most exciting period for railways in many generations. We're investing more money in rail than we've done for years and years. And I think we should all just celebrate that fact instead of going off trying to find bad news.
Sure. And I know it's not within your power, but wouldn't you welcome more government investment in the rest of the South West network, you know, into Devon and Cornwall, for instance?
Well, I would always welcome more investment. But I think if you look at what's already committed, there's a very, very substantial statement from both the last Labour government and this government about investing in the routes out of Paddington. We've got electrification now coming out of London to Oxford, to Newbury, to Bristol, Bristol Parkway and into South Wales. We've got a new fleet of intercity trains on order, and we've got the Crossrail service in London that will connect Paddington much, much more effectively to other parts of London. So people travelling up from the West Country on arrival at Paddington will be able to get to other parts of London more quickly than they can today. You know, my colleagues and I in the industry are doing a lot of work to look at what investment we might want beyond what's currently committed. But I think the investment that's already been committed is a great news story for the industry. It's great in particular for our customers. It's going to take a little while to deliver, but it's going to be delivered and it will make a massive difference to their journey experience.
Do you have any plans to give some hope to hard-pressed businesses and travellers in the peninsula?
We recognise that there's a need to try and connect London, Plymouth and particularly Cornwall to London faster. One of the things that we are looking at the moment is opportunities to improve journey times. We're doing that with Network Rail. I can't promise anything today, but we certainly recognise the aspirations of people in Cornwall to get to London more quickly.
So you can promise the people of Devon and Cornwall and indeed Gloucestershire will not be forgotten in this rush to electrify the main line itself?
No, absolutely. And of course, the new trains which will be serving the high-speed routes out of Paddington are designed very much with the objective of operating away from the electrified network. So a lot of the trains will be what we call bi-mode, so they'll have the ability to draw on the new electric supply, but they'll also have very powerful diesel engines to power them away from the electrified networks. For example, if you take the railway network west of Bristol to somewhere like Weston-super-Mare, The train will run as an electric train out of London. It will stop at places like Bath. It will get to Bristol. The electric pantograph will be lowered, and the diesel engines will take the same train in the same levels of comfort onto Weston-super-Mare.
Mark Hopwood of First Great Western. But Chris Irwin, European policy advisor to Passenger Focus, Britain's statutory watchdog for public transport, is far less bullish about future plans for railways in the southwest. Mr. Irwin is also an honorary doctor of business at Plymouth University and chairman of Transport Southwest. He says the southwest will need to shout louder to avoid being ignored because of the focus on HS2 and north-south rail links.
My argument has been for some time that when we had a Labour government, Labour didn't regard the southwest as particularly relevant to its heartlands. Now we have a coalition government. Because the southwest is so much coalition country, we rather get taken for granted. So we seem to lose both ways. I think it's very different if you're living in Manchester or Leeds or the northern cities, which are very capable lobbyists on their behalf. We haven't really managed to match that in the southwest. Partly, I fear, because the southwest people are, frankly, for their own good, rather too nice. They don't like having political rows.
So we should shout a bit louder.
We must shout louder. We must learn to work together as well, because that's been the other southwest weakness. Whereas in the north, one hears about the Northern Hub, great plans for a renaissance of public transport, railways, buses, all the rest of it, roads in the north. We in the southwest tend to fall into the trap of thinking just in our own local transport areas. Very hard to think beyond the boundaries. So even in the more advanced parts, like the west of England, where people are beginning to work together slowly, once they get beyond the immediate periphery of the west of England boundary, once they get into, let's say, West Wiltshire, which is in many ways a dormitory for Bristol and Bath and so on, they somehow lose interest. They forget that that's part of it. We really do lack that collective voice that would enable us as a southwest to have a real influence on national policy.
Would it help then if we had a kind of a regional transport undertaking of some kind?
I think we certainly need a regional transport strategy. I think that as money is increasingly devolved to local authorities, as we become more and more aware of the interdependence between the economies of one city and the economies of another conurbation, then we need to find ways of working together much more effectively. I know it may not be very popular to say this in political circles, but there is no doubt that the old Southwest Regional Assembly and the Southwest Regional Development Agency began to move in that direction and began to be quite effective in securing what we're getting now. For example, I do not believe that there would have been the early electrification of the Great Western Main Line that we have now had it not been for the combined authority of the Welsh Assembly Government, which was clearly very effective, but also of the South West RDA and the Regional Assembly in pressing the case for electrification over a number of years at the highest levels.
So we may have thrown the baby out with the bathwater in unravelling that bureaucracy. We've lost some advantages.
My fear is that while the LEPs may be able to do quite a lot, they won't quite have the clout of the regional voice. They're smaller, they don't have the skill base available to them, and they certainly don't have the resources potentially available to the region when acting as one.
Chris Irwin of Travel Watch Southwest, and that lesson about a strong, united regional voice is something that came to the fore when my colleague Christopher Slade took a trip to Brittany, often spoken of as France's equivalent of Cornwall, to find out how transport infrastructure works for business there.
Welcome to Brest in Brittany in France, in the region of Finistère. I'm standing in the middle of the city, and that's a tram just gone past me, one of the new trams that was put in here about a year ago at a cost of €383 million. This is the main street in Brest. It is now pedestrianised, except for trams, so it's changed totally. And the process of putting this in, which I can remember because I come here quite often, was complete digging up of the roads and moving of pipes and cables, and all the business people got very grumpy about it, and there were lots of complaining letters in the local paper. But that all seems to have settled down now. The tram's been running for about a year. It runs over about 14 kilometres and serves 50,000 people or so every day, and it has transformed the city, even to the extent that if you live near a tram station in the suburbs of Brest, the value of your property will go up.
À votre avis, quelle est la couleur du tram?
Vert, je pense.
Vert anis.
Oui.
Bérénice. Bon,
qu'est-ce que vous pensez,
parce que
madame?
Mon mari me dit jaune. Je dis, je te dis que c'est pas jaune, c'est Bérénice.
Oui,
merci.
Oui, okay.
She's just asking me what colour I think the tram is, so I said green, and her husband thinks it's yellow. So there we are.
There's another tram going in the other direction. It's an interesting region here. Brest, as you may know, is twinned with Plymouth in the southwest of the UK. Very similar place, a naval base, rebuilt after the war, and has had a lot of investment in it since. It's a very proud area, Brittany. They have their own national flag and identity. They produce things locally and regionally and sell them under that label in supermarkets and so on. So in terms of commerce, it's quite thriving. The disadvantage is it's quite a long way from Paris. The larger cities in this region are places like Rennes and Vannes, which are quite a way away, so many businesses have to travel there. Now, I've made some serious efforts to interview people in English, but have repeatedly been told it's August and holidays and no one's available. However, I did talk to one shop owner in town who said, re the tram, it was the 3 years of roadworks that lost him a lot of business. And now, with the tram there for a year, he still hasn't regained the numbers as people have completely changed their shopping habits. Well, that's something I didn't expect to hear after the joy of an opening of a new tram system. Well, I'm standing on the platform of Brest railway station next to a very impressive TGV, the Train Grand Vitesse, which speeds regularly to Paris and other closer, larger cities here in the region of Finisterre like Rennes. It's a very impressive train. It leaves here many times a day, but it is expensive and takes about 4.5 hours to get to Paris. And some of the business people here I've spoken to feel they don't have any alternative. It's a very long drive to do there and back in a day, for example, for business. Well, other big cities, Rennes, Nantes, are very slow by train. The TGV speeds only happen beyond those cities towards the capital. At last, an interview. Frédéric Herry works for Orange, the software part of their business, and runs a team here in Brest, but has to regularly travel to Orange's headquarters in Rennes, in Nantes and in Paris. So how does she regularly get about?
I fly to Paris, I go to Rennes by train, and I go to Nantes by car.
Is the flying very expensive?
Yes, flying is very expensive. But when you go to Paris, it's such a long time to go by train. It's 4.5 hours, so it's too long. When you go just for an appointment in a day, so you have to go by plane. To go by train to Rennes is not very expensive. It's about 80 euros for the go and return from Brest to Rennes.
With the business you're in, with Orange, when you have to travel for these meetings, does transport work well in Finisterre?
In Finisterre, you just use your car, so it's not very difficult. But when you go to Rennes, it's quite easy. There are a lot of trains, and it's not too expensive. It's quite fast as when you use your car. But when you go to Nantes, you don't have train to go from Brest to Nantes, so it's quite long. You have to go by car, and it's 3 hours in a day, or 6 hours if you need to go back. It would be better if we could have a real TGV to go to Paris, because Paris is quite far, and it's very expensive to go by plane. So to have a real TGV would be very good, to have maybe 3 hours of train from Brest to Paris. That would be good.
What about some conclusions in this rather unscientific look at transport in Brest in Brittany? With the trains, a lot of business people I've spoken to want the train to be even quicker to Paris. 4.5 hours at the moment. It's going to get quicker over the next few years. Many business people feel they have to use it because there's no alternative. So it is quite popular. And there are many, many services every day to Paris from Brest, for example. There's a good dual carriageway on the roads down to the bigger cities of Rennes and Nantes in the south of the region. A lot of people drive. And with the tram in Brest, that has really transformed the city. Business is booming and the traffic situation is much, much better. It's cheap, it's available, and it serves 50,000 people a day. And here's a clever thing. When the French in Brest were looking to buy their trams, they found that Dijon, the city of Dijon, was doing exactly the same thing. So they bought all their tram carriages together and got them more cheaply because of it. Cunning old French. Christopher Slade, looking into transport in Brittany for Southwest Business Report.
Back here in the southwest of England, we do like to complain about the roads, but perhaps with good cause. Traffic congestion is costing the economy more than £4.3 billion a year, or £491 per car commuting household. That's according to a survey in December last year by the Centre for Economics and Business Research. Robert Bailey, Director of Tax at the Truro office of Accountants Bishop Fleming, says poor transport links to and across Cornwall are not only a deterrent to tourism in the county, but also have a much wider effect on business.
I understand from my clients that the late summer bookings have been absolutely brilliant. They're expecting, despite a bad start, to have a better summer they've had for a number of years.
So in what way is the road system a deterrent if they're having such good bookings?
Well, we've seen this before. When we have a good summer, we have a good summer the following year, no matter what the weather, no matter what the conditions. Then we end up with a lag. A bad one produces a bad one to follow, no matter what the weather and what the conditions again. Now, if you're out on the roads these last few weekends, it's been horrendous again. We've had huge traffic jams. I've been driving out of the county on the A30, come across the pinch point at Temple, and beyond that, there's been a traffic jam, two lanes of solid parked traffic, with holidaymakers actually with their doors open and sat outside on their bonnets for mile after mile after mile. It's not a great experience, and if that is the beginning and the end of their holiday experience, then it's got to be something they'll think about again.
But isn't that, forgive me, but isn't that now being addressed? You mentioned the bottleneck at Temple, but isn't it the case that funding has now been agreed for dual carriageway at Temple to address exactly the thing you're talking about?
Yeah, the Temple one has been addressed. That is the worst point. It's the first of the pinch points on the way into the county, so it's the first one that really hits people coming down here. But we've then got a single line stretch of road between Carland Cross and Chiverton Cross. Now, it's a bit further into the county, so there will have been some traffic has peeled off to Newquay and the like, but it's still a major blockage there. As you head further west, you get down beyond Camborne, and it becomes single line with spells of these dreadful, dangerous three-lane roads all the way past Hale. And I mean, just a couple of weekends ago, I was stuck there for 35 minutes trying to get to a client during the day, midweek. The majority of our holiday area is in the west end of the county, and we've still got these major pinch points.
Apart from the holiday-making side of business in Cornwall, what about all the other businesses? Because am I not right in saying that the European Union, for one, has pumped a lot of money into the western side of Cornwall to help generate jobs?
We actually look at where the industry, where the jobs are, the non-leisure industry jobs. The majority of that is in the Camborne, Poole, Maidenhead area. A lot of money is being spent improving the local infrastructure in that area. We've got lots of factories being built. We've got link roads being put in. But if you've got someone coming into the county, setting up a factory or a distribution point, with all that fabulous infrastructure locally and with grant funding creating the jobs, but then their lorries have to get out onto the A30 and grind to a halt at various different points, then where's the long-term incentive? My concern is that we are becoming dependent upon these grants. When the grant goes, the jobs will just disappear as someone else. We need the job finishing. We need the dual carriageway at least through Chiverton and Carland, that link to actually connect Camborne, Poole, Maidenhead, our industrial heartland of the county. We need to connect that to the rest of the motorway network, to the rest of the county, to connect these people to their markets. We're a long way west, and we're making it worse by having this blockage, this blood clot in our main artery.
So given that the kind of problems you've been talking about presumably affect pretty much all of Cornwall's business community, what can they do, or what can anybody do?
Roads is essentially the only game in town, and we've got to get on to Whitehall and campaign for a fairer share of the funds available. When you look at some of the projects being mooted at the moment as part of George Osborne's investment for jobs, etc., in infrastructure, they're talking about adding a second motorway link in South Wales. They've already got a motorway. They're talking about putting a second one in. We'd like our first, please. In fact, not even a motorway. Just give us a dual carriageway. We need to get onto our MPs and get a share of that money, a fair share of the money.
Robert Bailey in Truro. One of the problems which besets the planning and funding of road improvement schemes is actually pinning down who's responsible. The Department of Transport, through its agency, the Highways Agency, are responsible for some major trunk road planning. County councils have responsibility for other routes. And now the government has invented a new type of body, local transport boards, to try to pull together the strands at local level. But before they even got off the ground, government decided to cut their budgets. Surprise, surprise. Cornwall Local Transport Board has an annual budget of just £8.5 million. That's about £4.5 million less than expected. Its chair is Councillor Bert Biscoe.
It is disappointing that what we were given as an indicative sum for local transport boards has actually been reduced. We were told something that was around about 13 to 14 million, and actually what we've got is about 8.5.
Which is very disappointing.
Well, it is,
What can you do with that £8 million?
Well, I think that depends. Firstly, I think that it's really important that the LEP is involved, and indeed, so is the Local Nature Partnership and the Health and Wellbeing Board, because they are all structures, you know, organisations that are there to thread together packages of funding against sets of criteria, basically playing the funding game, isn't it?
So it's possible you might get more, you might get some top-up funds?
We've got an 8.5 million stake, which enables us to go bidding against other people, against criteria, in order to be able to produce transport outcomes.
So what will those criteria be? What are your priorities?
Well, that depends. I mean, Cornwall is in the unique and privileged position of being a structural funds region, and therefore we will be able, within the limitations of the criteria of the new convergence programme, which may well be quite limited in terms of transport infrastructure, we'll be able to be bidding into that, as indeed we have done in the past. What we've now got is an 8.5 million stake of government capital we can use according to our priorities. The outcomes will be affected as a result. I mean, you're not going to see mega schemes coming from this. What you might see is a good variety of schemes, particularly schemes that are looking at the future development and evolution of transport infrastructure.
It's early days, I know, but what do you expect your priorities to be? I mean, are you specifically in favour of dualling the whole of the A30?
That's a moot question, really. We're beginning to see some facing up to realities about resource depletion, you know, materials and fuel, about the need to clean up the planet, and also the need to bring technology and transport together in order to produce more efficient and outcome-driven transactions.
So with respect, it doesn't sound as if business in Cornwall can expect much improvement to the infrastructure.
Well, hang on. What are we going to look at is what I'm driving at here. Now, it may be that in the longer-term strategic picture, that producing a dualling of the A30 all the way down is not the best use of the money if you look at how your transport infrastructure is going to evolve over the next, say, 30 years. So if you look at Cornwall and where it is, it's a long way from most places. It's got very highly developed technological infrastructure. We've got the new broadband project and so on. We are a community which is entirely reliant on importing food and commodities on a daily basis. With the convoy coming down the A30 is huge. That's a significant social and economic factor in looking at how we manage the future and our infrastructure. How will we move goods around in 10, 15, 20, 30 years' time if we've got to reduce carbon, if materials and fuels are depleting, if, as of yet, we haven't seen any alternative fuels that are likely to keep things moving? Costs of that trucked convoy every night are rising even as we speak. So therefore, it behoves us to look at the potential for evolving the railway, which moves a lot of stuff around with a great deal less energy expended, and to look at shipping, because we're in a good position because most of Cornwall is surrounded by the ocean. So we've got more than just roads to look at. It's not to say that we're not looking at roads. I wonder whether in the strategic picture that will emerge over the next, say, 15 to 20 years, whether priorities around having dual carriageways and motorways will be quite so great as they seem to be at the moment.
Well, that's interesting, because so many people have said to us that dualling that A30 is absolutely key to getting away from Cornwall's isolationism.
I don't think Cornwall is isolationist, but I do think Cornwall is isolated, or at least I think Cornwall has been isolated. I mean, I've just come from a conversation with the manager of the Act Now project, which is about it putting in broadband infrastructure, which will serve roughly 90 to 95% of people in Cornwall by the time we get to the end of the convergence programme in 2015.
But it doesn't move good.
But no, it doesn't move goods, but it completes an awful lot of transactions that at the moment and in the past people have moved around in order to do. It doesn't move goods, no, but I mean, you know, the truck as an environmental impact, as a consumer of resources and so on, and as an efficient way of moving things around, is not necessarily going to be the best way to do things moving forward. So by the time it becomes possible to develop schemes to completely dual the A30, for instance, we may well find that priorities in terms of transport provision have changed quite significantly.
So cold comfort there for Robert Bailey and other A30 campaigners. Road congestion and a lack of public transport links is not just a Cornish problem. Mike Henry of Jones Lang LaSalle in Bristol is a member of the Business West Transport Committee. He says investment in transport is absolutely critical to unlocking economic growth.
We have very heavily congested roads, the slowest road average road speed outside London. The buses are regarded as expensive and slow, and the rail service is good in part, but certainly doesn't serve the whole city properly.
So why is that important? I mean, clearly it's inconvenient, but does it have a real effect on business? Well, is there evidence of that?
Yeah, I mean, the real bottom line is that investment in transport is absolutely critical to unlocking economic growth. I mean, I think it's an irony that when the government decided to open up South Wales in the late 60s, early 70s, they invested heavily in a motorway called the M4 and the high-speed rail link from London to South Wales, and by a fluke of nature, it skims the top of Bristol. And look what that's done for North Bristol. When those transport links were finished, we saw companies saying we can move from London to Bristol, and that started the big migration of very big insurance companies and banks down to Bristol.
So all that business development around Bristol Parkway, for instance?
Direct result of fantastic transport links. Before the early 70s, Bristol was famous for making paper and tobacco and Concord. But since then, we've got a far more broader base of business. That's a brilliant example. Had that motorway and rail line gone south of Bristol, we would have a fantastically prosperous South Bristol.
And have we, in your view, missed out on inward investment because moving around within the Greater Bristol area is so difficult?
I think there are issues increasingly along those lines where there is this perception, it's not always necessarily the case, but there is a perception that the transport within Bristol is not up to scratch. Moving people quickly, cheaply, safely around a city like Bristol is very, very important.
We've heard from our reporter Chris Slade in Brest, actually, about the difference that the new tram system there has made. Here, of course, we've seen metro and tram proposals come and go for decades. There seems little chance of sorting out the city's congestion through any kind of light rail system.
No, I think that's not fair. We are on the edge of three metro schemes, they're now called, which is the Bristol Rapid Transit schemes. There's three schemes. There's Ashton Vale to Temple Meads line, which is somewhere along the track, if I excuse the pun. We've got the link to North Bristol, Hengrove, and the South Bristol link, which is in for planning. So we are dangerously close now to maybe making some progress in that area. I'm not saying that they will solve all the problems, but it's a good start.
So, Mike, we now have local transport boards, and there's one for the west of England. Funding, of course, is reduced. Is there a need for a more powerful transport authority for the Greater Bristol area, a strategic organisation?
Well, certainly transport authorities in Manchester and the north and other places north of England have demonstrated that progress can be made quickly. But I wouldn't knock us too badly. We are seeing some joined up thinking between the local authorities who are recognising we can't just look at, say, Bristol on its own. We're linked to North Somerset, South Gloucestershire, etc. And they are talking and working together. The South Bristol link, which is in for planning at the moment, is a classic example where the relevant local authorities in North Somerset and Baines and Bristol have, because the road will cross various boundaries, recognise it's a single issue, and I think there's some good work has been done there. There's some way to go with the South Bristol link, but that again will be a wonderful example, if it happens, of unlocking economic growth. I mean, an independent report produced earlier this year says at least 4,000 jobs should be created out of that area, which desperately needs them. Unfortunately, a lot of us have a distorted view of Bristol because certainly north of the river, everything looks busy and high levels of GDP, etc. But we know south, in southern parts of Bristol, you have some of the highest disadvantaged areas in the country. And a road, the South Bristol link, will really bring some good news to that part of the world.
Mike Henry concluding our report on road and rail links. Our next edition in October, we'll look at the equally vexed issue of air transport. If you'd like to comment on this report or if you have any suggestions for future reports, please get in touch via the Contact Us page on the website. This is Magnus Carter saying thanks for listening.